welcome to episode 119 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We're here today with Micah Meyer, adventurer and national parks road tripper, who seeks to increase LGBT visibility in outdoor and travel industries and to encourage youth involvement in the parks. Micah, how are you doing today?
Good. Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. The first question I'd like to pose to you is, what are you currently doing or what have you ever done to advance the public interest and why?
Well, basically, right now I am on a world record road trip to all 417 U.S. National Park Service sites. And as far as public interest goes, when I started this trip, I found out that the National Park Service had a hard time reaching both young audiences and the LGBT community. So I added it as a goal of mine to help spread awareness for the National Park Service to help them in their goals, but also as an openly gay man who grew up in the state of Nebraska, where I thought gay people were only drag queens or wore Speedos on floats. I'm doing this as a way to help, you know, the past me, the future me, and the entire LGBT community to basically break stereotypes and create a new role model that doesn't exist so I can expand the narrative of what it means to be gay in America.
So what does it mean to be gay in America?
Well, I think we're at a really exciting time. I actually just wrote a blog about the Pennsylvania Avenue National Historic Site where I reminisced about being at DC Pride in 2013. And they have a stage set up with the U.S. Capitol behind it, and a drag queen comes out and does her comedy act. And at one point, she turns to the crowd and she says, "Isn't it amazing that I can do this now?" And so, you know, with everything that's happened politically in the past 5 years, I think we're at a really exciting time, but also culturally, you know, the fact that I can be open and out in these news stories that I do, you know, even 10 or 15 years ago might not be possible. You know, I still have to deal with the fears of companies potentially might not want to sponsor my journey because there are no openly gay figures in the outdoor industry. There are no openly gay travel show hosts, which is one thing I hope to change. So we are still in this gray area where things are better, but they're not normal yet for the LGBT community as far as being equal parts of the American story.
I see. So you said that growing up in the Midwest, there was a certain stereotyped image of the homosexual population, and it sounds like what you're doing now is trying to break down those stereotypes. Is that true?
Totally. I mean, so when I grew up, I did not know any openly gay adults. It wasn't until college that I met someone who I knew personally who, you know, admitted to being gay and lived with a partner. And I think it's interesting because on this journey so far, I've been through the entire state of North Dakota and did a number of newspapers and local news stations there, and I always told them about my LGBT focus, and none of them ever mentioned it. Whereas when I went to New York State, every single news source mentioned it. Hmm. So I think it's a good example of how there are many communities in the United States where it's a very taboo topic, such that it's not even talked about. Or when my hometown newspaper did an update on my trip, they wrote about this LGBT goal, and they actually wrote me ahead of time and said, "We know this is a very sensitive issue, so we want to make sure we absolutely got all your words right before we publish it."
Mm-hmm.
So it's just interesting to see something.
What is the kind of the response you've gotten from listenership or readership from these media outlets about your particular identity?
Well, that's what's interesting. So at the beginning of my trip, I didn't talk about LGBT directly. I just said diversity, and I allowed people to kind of find that out on my website as they looked harder because I was afraid that people would lose the forest for the trees and they might not follow this national parks journey just because I'm gay.
Mm-hmm.
However, as I've done this, you know, LGBT park rangers have reached out to me, kids from around the country, adults from around the world have written me and said, "Thank you so much for doing what you're doing. It is helping our community. And, you know, I finally saw someone who represented this part of me that I never saw in the media before." So, you know, the more I do this, the more I realize how important it is for me to make sure that's included in the media.
So America is often portrayed as a country of firsts. We're very interested in having the first black president in Barack Obama. We're having the first, you're always very interested in the first woman representing this district, the first African American, the first LGBT going to all national parks. Why is it that it matters? What's important about being the first LGBT person to visit every national park in the United States?
Well, to start with, I would say the important thing for me about doing this is that, you know, I think when most people see, oh, wow, somebody completed a world record for visiting all the National Park Service sites, they'll think of some burly, rugged man who's probably heterosexual. So,
are you a burly, rugged man who's homosexual?
I am not. I am a tall, skinny, pale, white dude who happens to be gay. And so I think that, you know, when people see that, it'll hopefully break their idea of their stereotypes of gay people. You know, they might think we're only effeminate, or we only like to shop, or we don't like to be outdoors. And so beyond just the first stuff, I think it's important to set that example.
So speaking of the outdoors, you're on a road trip, which is somewhat indoors, because I imagine you being inside the car for a great deal of time. So to what extent are you outdoors? What's transpiring on this road trip?
Well, so I actually live in a cargo van that I converted myself into kind of a studio apartment on wheels. So depending on your definition of indoors and outdoors, I sleep outdoors every night, whether that's in a parking lot or on a side street or wherever I can find a place to pull over my van.
Mm-hmm.
So to that extent, though, it's, you know, some national parks are sweeping landscapes of mountains or caverns or canyons, and other National Park Service sites are the Washington Monument or the Belmont Paul Women's Equality House. You know, they're just a building instead of 100,000 acres. So it's a variation between going into urban settings and doing stuff that people might consider touristy, and, you know, doing a 10-mile hike that takes all day.
What was the inspiration for this whole trip? And how did you ever come to connect the desire to visit all these national parks with this sense of advancing an LGBT agenda, and on the other hand, advancing really a millennial agenda? You said that you're trying to help parks reach out to young people. So how did you get this idea?
Well, to the latter part of your question, I've always been very active in the LGBT community. I volunteered a lot for the Human Rights Campaign in the D.C. area. I also founded an organization for the D.C., Maryland, Virginia area called Queer for Christ, which is the world's largest in-person gathering of young adult LGBT Christians. So Advocacy has always been something that's important to me. My father's a pastor, so I grew up with this idea that, you know, our faith compels us to be people of social justice. To that degree, my dad was 58 when he passed away. I was 19 at the time, and he was a big fan of road trips. And so I coincidentally had my first ever road trip planned for 10 days after his funeral. And so every year since age 19, that was such a healing experience for me that I've done one road trip to honor him, honor the life that he lost, and essentially try to carpe diem, try to live for today because tomorrow's not guaranteed. So it was on one of those road trips that I came up with this goal of when I turned 30 that I would do something epic, something big. And I remembered national parks from my past road trips, and I'd been to a handful and thought that it would be a cool goal just to see if I could see all of them.
So you've been going around the country in a van. And
van down by the river.
And you've been trying to... I'm sure you have. How is this even possible? I'm sure a lot of people in a lot of cubicles may be listening to this episode right now and wondering, you know, gosh, sounds like a perpetual vacation to me. If only I didn't have to pay my bills, or how would I even afford to feed myself? You mentioned that you received some sponsorships. How is it they're actually making this possible?
Yeah, so I actually get a lot of hate mail. People call me a lazy millennial. They call me a trust fund baby. They say that I'm on a 4-year vacation. And I always wish those people would just read the article or go to my blog, because if they do, they would find out that, you know, this is the hardest I've ever worked in my life. I spend about 75% of my time doing admin work and only about 25% in the parks. And that's 7 days a week, 24/7.
What kind of admin work? You mean on the website?
No, well, so to fund this trip, basically I worked three jobs for 4 years in the Washington, D.C. area. I sang as a professional singer at the Washington National Cathedral. I did administrative work for Georgetown Prep High School, and I also lived in the high school as a dorm parent taking care of the kids, so I didn't have to pay D.C. area rent for 4 years, which helped me save up enough that I can start this trip, but I don't have enough to finish. So basically every day I'm either writing blogs, so I have content put out in the world, so maybe people will go to my website and donate, or I'm contacting media, trying to get in local news or local newspapers so people will find out about my trip and follow along, share with LGBT people, increase those goals, but also maybe donate. I'm sharing on social media on any given day about yesterday's park, experiencing today's park, and planning for tomorrow's park, logistics of what time the visitor center opens, where am I going to shower, where am I going to eat. So it's like this nonstop project where I'm hustling. There's no downtime. It's not like vacation, relaxing on a beach with my favorite book.
So, but yet you are getting sponsorships and you are receiving donations. Clearly, your trip is inspiring others. Either, as you mentioned just a moment ago, you're inspiring others to send you hate mail, but also you also mentioned earlier that you're inspiring others in a very positive way, saying that people around the world, especially members of the LGBT community, have been reaching out to you. What do you think is so inspiring about this trip to them? And let's start with that.
Well, if it's one thing I think is universal, you know, whether you're gay, straight, black, white, whatever, we all have dreams. We all have things we want to do with our life that we hope to do. And so, you know, I learned this lesson at a young age that we can't take life for granted. And so I hope that no matter who you are, if you see my journey, that whatever your dreams are or whatever crazy idea you've had for your life that you don't think is possible, you can see me doing this and maybe feel like your dreams and your goals aren't so crazy. And that, you know, if you plan, there's a will, there's a way. And so I hope that this journey inspires people to carpe diem, live for today, and not assume that tomorrow's guaranteed. So they should follow their dreams now if they can.
So that's quite inspirational, the sense of, you know, but you did plan, you know, you had these dreams for years and yet you were able to do jobs and you were to live in a dormitory. You were able to delay gratification while you saved enough money to finance the first portion of your trip. Is that not true?
Yeah, that is true. You know, in a sense, it's kind of like many people might spend their lives saving up for their retirement, you know, saving up money. So when 65 happens, and basically my thought was that, like my dad, I might not make it to 65. So if I can do this on a smaller scale, then at least whatever happens to me, I won't ever have to say I didn't get to try, you know?
So you have so many identities that you're juggling, whether it's your sexual orientation, your identity as an outdoorsman, an adventurer, a self-described adventurer. There's also something that you've spoken about briefly, but I'd like to ask you to take a moment to elaborate upon. You said that you, and on your website, you're listed as essentially an accomplished singer, a choral vocalist. Could you speak about the reception you have when you go around the country and you sing with people, especially in light of the story, the narrative of this journey of yours? How do people receive you?
Yeah. So I do have my undergrad and master's degree in classical music performance, and I'm actually a countertenor, which is a male alto or male soprano. That's what I sang at the cathedral, because they have a choir of men and boys there where professional adult men sing alto.
And that's unusual, correct?
Yeah, so first off, I usually explain to people about the historical context of the voice, lest they chuckle because they aren't used to hearing a man sing in that range. But yeah, it's, you know, it's another part of me. I think our culture likes one sentence sound bites. We like easy segments. We like to put people in boxes as you are a basketball player or you are a lawyer. And, you know, I hope that me talking about the parks and then people find out I'm also a professional singer just shows that, you know, we don't have to put people into easily definable boxes. We can have multiple interests and have multiple layers of ourselves.
So life is messy is essentially what you're trying to say.
Life is gray. That's one of the lessons I learned from my mentors in college. Life is not black and white.
Well, just before we delve deeper into that notion, I'd like to just, you said that you often provide context about, historical context about how men can sing in the vocal range that you sing in. Would you mind providing our listeners with that context?
Yeah, well, so essentially in the 1700s, you know, in history, there was a point where women weren't allowed to do anything in church, and that included singing. And so in British choirs, they would have trained male altos sing the alto part of an SATB choir, and then boys sing soprano.
What is an SATB?
Oh, sorry, soprano, alto, tenor, bass. Basically, any choir you'd hear anywhere that's kind of a general makeup of voice parts.
Mm-hmm.
And so traditionally nowadays, women sing soprano and alto and men sing tenor and bass. But at the time, women weren't allowed to participate. So they had to do it with boys and men to physically make it possible.
And that was in the theater, too. They had men play women's roles on stage, like in Shakespeare's time.
Yeah, totally. So Juliet was a dude. And in the 1700s, they actually, young boys who had musical promise, they were castrated so their voices wouldn't change. And these men were called castrati and essentially were the rock stars. They were the Justin Timberlake of the 1700s because they could sing higher and louder than anyone in existence, any man, any woman, because of their physical stature and the fact that their voices never changed. So eventually we stopped that.
I guess it's a comment of society that we no longer make eunuchs of our minors. But it does sound interesting, kind of a weird full circle in that a few centuries ago, we had men essentially dressing in drag on the stage. And now, once again, we have men dressing in drag in front of the Capitol building and are slowly becoming accepted for doing that. And then you're advancing the LGBT cause as a soprano or as an alto around the country. It's kind of a nice circle that's completed there.
Well, and it's fun because, you know, these castratis weren't even dressed in drag. They were dressed up as men. They were often, usually the people who could sing highest in traditional opera were always the heroes. So the John Wayne of these operas was a castrati.
Huh.
So, yeah, hopefully there's something heroic to this journey I'm doing, and that's a nice parallel you drew between the castrati countertenors and me.
And also, and I was mentioning the actors who had to play the female roles back in the 17th and 18th centuries. So, so you're driving around the country, and tell us some of your. I'm sure you've encountered some crazy stories, some titillating tales. What could you share with our listeners?
Well, it's funny. I was joking with a radio host recently because everyone wants the story of, like, I was driving down the highway in Minnesota and my tire popped off and, you know, I skidded into the ditch and a guy in a pickup truck came by and picked me up and his dog, you know, whatever on my car. And unfortunately, I don't have that yet. As I say, I spent 4 years planning for this, so I planned ahead and got, you know, a vehicle with a maintenance plan. And so I'm hoping I'm avoiding a lot of those, like, trial and error stories just on good planning.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that, you know, I've only been to 24 states so far, but everywhere I go, I'm always impressed by both the diversity our country has and the similarities we have. You know, you go to one state and people act in a certain way or in the rural or urban areas, but yet everybody's got a Panera brand. Everybody's got, you know, a Target. And so even as we are so diverse across the country in our cultures to where North Dakota newspapers won't mention me being gay and New York ones play it up, we still all have such a shared common culture.
So there's so many common touch points, yet we have enormous regional, cultural, geographic diversity spread around this nation.
It's an amazing country.
So a lot of people sitting in different parts of the country are often commenting upon how they feel as though there are increasingly two different Americas generally this is offered within a political context, especially in light of different elections. And oftentimes, many individuals across the country find it quite difficult to comprehend how people with differing opinions could exist and support the individuals that they did support. Have you gleaned any insight around the country as to how people in some part of the country may view people in the other part of the country, and really what accounts for this, what is perceived to be a growing divide among the different peoples of the United States?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, and it's so apropos to this journey, because I understand, having been to these different parts of America, how if you don't ever get a chance to leave where you grew up and you only experience one type of person, it is hard to imagine that the people in those states or over there or them are good, caring people who have similar goals. So I hope that even if it's just next door to the nearest state or even another country, that as people have a chance to travel, they find these commonalities and they realize that those people, whether they're down the block or in another state, share so many common values. You know, most people, well, everyone deep down just wants to love and be loved. And I think all of our actions are a reaction to that desire. So I think the more people realize that, the more they'll see their shared humanity.
Well, we are approaching the end of the podcast. So I would like to ask you a final question, which is to reflect upon this trek of public service. In fact, beyond this trek, your career to date, your life to date of public service, whether helping the boys in the school, working as an advocate on the human rights campaign, and just take a moment and reflect upon your motivations. Why is it so important to give back and to do public service? And as you move forward, what do you hope your legacy will be at the end of this long journey that is your life?
Ooh, loaded question. gosh. Yeah, I think – so my dad was a Lutheran pastor. At one point, he actually won the award for best Lutheran campus pastor in America. So I grew up, with not only the pressures of being a pastor's kid, but the pressures of being a pastor's kid of a nationally recognized religious figure. And when I came out of the closet in my 20s, I felt so fortunate that because of that network, I knew religious figures in my denomination who were supportive of my sexual orientation, so I could go to them. And it was tough, but I made it through, and I'm a happy, healthy, gay Christian now. And when I look around the country, I see that so many people were not as lucky as I was. So I feel this immense responsibility to use the privilege I had to help other people. And going forward, you know, I joke that every blog I write can't just be a who, what, when, where, why. I feel this desire to have it have a deeper meaning. And as I look back to being a kid and listening to my dad preach the gospel every Sunday, I think about that. Because as he said, working at a college campus, some students might only come to church one time in 4 years. So if you don't have a good gospel message that Sunday, they might never come back. So as I look at my writing and everything I've done, I find this common thread that pretty much everything I write all comes back to a goal of bringing people together. And so I hope that my legacy, whether it's through this trip, through my advocacy, and other avenues, will somehow bring our broken world together.
So that is Micah Meyer, self-described adventurer and national parks road tripper who works to advance LGBT visibility in outdoor and travel industries while encouraging youth involvement in the parks. For Micah, life is a sermon where he seeks to convey the importance of loving and being loved. He is an inspiration to others, and he recognizes that life is a messy gray area and seeks to transcend the sound bites and pigeonholes that we each try to characterize each other as, and really promote messy human understanding where we are complex beings. And in this world which you frankly will never get out alive, you are best advised as Micah says to walk through it together, hand in hand. For Micah, his journey across this nation is about embracing a spirit of carpe diem, while also physically and metaphorically seeking to broaden horizons, both his own and those whom he comes in contact with across this great nation that is the United States. Micah, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. And if people want to follow along,
people want to follow along, what is your blog?
Yeah, if people want to follow along, they can just Google Micah Meyer or go to tbcmicah.com.
tbcmicah.com. And for our listeners, this has been episode 119 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. Please subscribe at publicinterestpodcast.com. Go on iTunes or on Apple products, your podcast app, in order to listen to the podcast. Should you wish to communicate with Micah, you can leave a voicemail for him at the number listed on the Contact Us page of the website. Thank you so much for joining us, and we will talk to you next time.